So in the song Good Old Girls, which you've just released, there's a strong autobiographical vibe here. How much of this is true, and how could you use that song to help us know where you're from and what, how your journey began?
Well, I mean, really, every bit of it's true. I certainly part of the inspiration was after winning the CMA award and, or after being nominated. I wrote it before I won it, and but I wanted to tell my story in a song, and I also wanted to inspire those little girls out there that are practicing their fiddles on their front porches. And so, yeah, from the first verse, you know, I listened to Bob Wills and Ray Price and Willie Nelson and in the background of my life. I played classical music. I started it when I was 3, but I would hear all these country music records. And yeah, by the time I was 5 years old, I started playing Faded Love. I just heard it. And one day I remember standing up on this chest, maybe a cedar chest, and I just played it for my mom and dad. And I just learned it by ear, because my dad would play those Bob Wills records in the background.
What was it about your family that had them get you started seriously on an instrument, you know, lessons that young?
My mom saw some little kids in the newspaper with their little violins. And she just thought, I guess, that it would be cute if, you know, her little girl played violin. And so she signed me up with the Suzuki. The kids in the newspaper were, I guess, taking the Suzuki classical method. So she signed me up for the Suzuki classical school. And, I mean, I played Suzuki till, I mean, I went through probably books 7 or 8.
I did the same thing.
You did? I didn't know that.
Yeah, sure did.
Oh, well,
yep.
you know.
That was my introduction to reading music. Yep.
Oh, that's great. And I totally recommend the Suzuki method. You know, they really did it by the book. Every night I would fall asleep to the Suzuki violin tapes. And it's so funny because, like, my first recital is when I was, like, 4 and a half, I believe. And you had to play 20-something songs. And as I was learning these songs, my teacher, I would get to song number 5 or 6, say. And she's like, Janae's having trouble learning this one. And we realized I would fall asleep before that song would come on. would start playing on my cassette
the subliminal
tape. Yeah. So mom would start the cassette tape at song 5. So I would at least be awake to learn to learn the next ones. So I really know that's where I developed my ear. I believe it's a God gift, but they definitely put in the work, and I practiced an hour a day and all that good stuff.
And obviously country melodies and country style fiddling just appealed to you. Was that something your family was all about? And how did you get drawn into the very different way of holding the bow, of feeling rhythm, of everything that's, you know, you can't, some classical students have to kind of unlearn some things to play country music right on the fiddle.
Yeah, it's interesting. Mom, I think her dream for me was actually to go to Juilliard and have that path.
Wow.
In life.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like when I started playing, when I realized I could play these songs that I was hearing on the radio or on these records that my dad was playing, I guess I could blame it on my dad because he was playing these country music. He's the one that wanted me to be the country fiddle player. And
okay.
So I was picking up these songs by ear, and then I'm sure they, because they started taking me to different fiddle players after that. There were some amazing local fiddle players. They got me in the Northwest Arkansas Fiddlers Association. And when I was, you know, 6, 7 years old, I'm jamming with these guys that are 70 and 80 years old just down the road from me. So that definitely was inspiring for me. Just going to jam sessions and bluegrass festivals and all that. And just growing up in Arkansas, I didn't grow up in the country, but I definitely listened to country music and my family listened to country music. Actually, one of the, my mom made it a point, I had to practice an hour a day, but when I was done practicing my classical music, you know, she was really good about like having treats, or I'd have sticker charts or whatever. But one of the things, the prizes I got was to listen to Willie Nelson's Whiskey River. And I remember going wild when I would hear Willie Nelson, and I just remember jumping on the bed to Whiskey River. That's an early memory of mine.
Brilliant. So then, in the song and in life, you're 18 years old and head to Nashville, yeah?
Uh-huh, yeah, right out of high school, come to Nashville.
So by that point, you had your eyes set on this town, and what did it represent to you? What did it feel like, and how strange was it to you, or had you made some visits?
I had been to Nashville before. I actually made an album in Nashville when I was about 16. And I knew I just had it in my heart that I was going to move to Nashville probably as early as 11 or 12 years old. I just knew the music I was hearing on the radio, that I wanted to be a part of that someday. And Robbie Turner, legendary steel guitar player. At the time, I was playing fiddle at a lot of steel guitar conventions in my teenage years. And Robbie Turner said I could come to a studio and record an album. And I did an album in Nashville when I was 16. So I knew a lot of players that lived in Nashville before, and I did my homework before I moved to town. But, you know, out of high school, Mom wanted me to finish school. I'm sure I would have moved way earlier, but finished high school and got here as fast as I could. And, you know, I just didn't want to be sitting around with nothing to do. So I knew I wanted to go to college, and I went to Belmont. And just a couple weeks after I moved to town, I walked in the Station Inn, and Larry Cordell was playing. Larry wrote Highway 40 Blues and Murder on Music Row and so many legendary country songs. And Brandon Rickman happened to be playing bass for him. And they said, get your fiddle. Brandon said, get your fiddle and come play for Larry. And I ended up playing in the green room. I didn't know it was it ended up being kind of an audition, because Larry ended up calling me the next week asking me if I wanted the job playing with him.
Right.
So, I got a job like 2 or 3 weeks after moving to town, and I played the Grand Ole Opry. And this is all in the song Good Old Girls. And played the Grand Ole Opry about a month after moving. And talk about a dream come true. Like, it was an absolute dream. I remember seeing the skyline of Nashville driving to the Opry, and I'm like, is this real? Like, is this happening? And so I was very, very fortunate.
That's absolutely excellent. Tell me about when songwriting began for you.
You know, songwriting, when I moved to town, and before I moved to town, I was so focused on my fiddle playing, and just my mom wanted me to, quote unquote, perfect the playing the violin. Nothing's ever perfect, of course, but when I moved to town, honestly, it wasn't until I started working with Larry Cordell that I knew the power of a song. He would come in, we would play the Station Inn every other week, Wednesday nights, and he would come in and play new songs he'd written. And, you know, I'm like 18, 19, and he'd play a song, and I'm like, what did that song just say? And I'm embarrassed to say that I didn't pay much attention to the lyrics. And I quickly realized, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm missing something here. And so it didn't take me long then to realize that this is a very important piece to the puzzle. And now, playing on so many sessions, like, the song tells you what to play. I was telling somebody, you know, like in I'll Name the Dogs that I played on Blake Shelton's record, and he mentions a swing, like a front porch swing. And when I heard that lyric, I just knew what to play. Like, I want to play a lick here that sounds like a swing. So, but then I knew, you know, like, after a while, that I wanted to write songs. So, it wasn't until I joined Terry Clark's band that, I thought, you know, I had some extra time, and I was like, I want to write songs. So I got Larry Cordell and Jerry Sally. Jerry was so, they were always so kind, and we would write together, and I learned so much. I was so green. But you got to start somewhere. And I had a goal in mind. I'm like, I want to get some songs cut. And I worked really, really, really hard at it. And my first cut was a song called I Am Strong that the Grascals ended up cutting. I wrote it with Jamie Johnson and Suzanne Johnson of the Grascals. And Dolly Parton ended up singing on it. And that was my first cut, quite a few years ago. I can't remember what year, but I've been really lucky and had quite a few songs cut since then.
Did anybody ever sort of telegraph to you that in Nashville, there's sort of a songwriter lane and a instrumentalist lane, and that it's going to be really tough to live in both, or not so much?
I don't think anybody ever, you know, came out and said that, but sometimes you just kind of feel that. And I think even now, sometimes I feel that, you know, like I'll do sessions for artists, and sometimes I think, gosh, I have a great song. I have a song that I want to pitch to them, but you're like, you're probably known as the session guy in their world. And then there's the other side of it too, where I've had songs cut, but I didn't play fiddle on this song, and you know, maybe they see me more of a songwriter. So yeah, sometimes you feel that, but I don't know. I think these days, like, the hard part for me is I'm my own publisher, so I'm my own song plugger too. So, you know, I hate bugging people. There's so many people like trying to get in contact with these artists. So I usually don't pitch a song unless I really, really, really believe in it.
As a musician who has played at high levels in the Station Inn kind of vibe, the Larry Cordell world, and know and cherish that pick inside of country music, and been on the mega stage and the arenas and seen that side of the industry, and, you know, recognizing what does and doesn't get on the radio and get promoted and become lucrative and all that. What's your kind of, what have you settled on as a philosophy and a way of looking at that sort of interesting dichotomy of Nashville? Some see it as a schism where, you know, country music split into a hyper commercial world and the other indie world with integrity, and others see more of a continuum. What's your take on that whole big picture?
That's interesting. You know, I kind of skate this line. Like, I love, love, love playing bluegrass, and I could just sit and jam playing bluegrass, you know, all day. But, you know, playing on the commercial side, you realize there's sometimes in these, you know, I hear bluegrassers or whoever complaining, like, well, I don't like country music, or just people that love traditional country music. They're like, it ain't what it used to be. And, but it's never going to, like, it's always changing. It always has been, you know, and people have to remember it is a business, and we have to make a living. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff on the radio that I don't love, but I get it. You know, and I'm trying to write. Sometimes you try to write for radio, and sometimes I'm in a writer's room and I'm like, it's, you know, like, I'd much rather be writing a bluegrass song, but it is a business, and I, you know, I like to eat. So I think some people forget that part. But I don't know. I just love every aspect of the business. I love the really songwritery stuff. But then on the other hand, there's some commercial stuff that I think's fantastic. And it yep. might only have two chords and might be really poppy and drum loop driven. But gosh, if it's a great song, like, you just can't deny a great song. But this is interesting. I played on a session recently for Sam Hunt, and that was definitely a session that I did not think I'd get a call to play on, or any fiddle to get a call to play on, just because his stuff's really, really pop country. And it was so yep. fun getting to experiment, and, it, you know, I can't wait for people to hear it, 'cause it's, I don't know. It's really cutting edge, and I love it. Like, I've played fiddle for Steven Tyler for the past few years. So, and that's been one of the most fun things and most creative things I've ever done. Just as a fiddle player, that's not something you think you're going to get a call to do.
Yeah.
But my goodness.
Tell me a little more about that setting, about what the band is like and what the feeling. I mean, we know what. Is that him solo versus Aerosmith, or you know, what's been the gig?
So he came to Nashville 3 or 4 years ago, and he cut a country record. Of course, it still sounds like Steven Tyler. He's always going to sound like Steven Tyler. But the band is called Loving Mary, and Marty Fredrickson is the band leader. And Marty wrote Jaded and a lot of hits for him, and is one of his best friends, and put together a country band for him, or a band that could do both the Aerosmith stuff and his country stuff. So I kind of came to the party late. I was asked to come play in the studio. And as I was leaving the session, and my connection was with Rebecca Lynn Howard.
You know who that is? Yep, absolutely.
One of my dear friends. And as I was leaving the session, I said, hey, if y'all ever need fiddle on the road, let me know. You know, I have time. And, you know, like, not, I didn't think much about it. I was just, I had time on my hands. And if I didn't, I got a call from Steven Tyler the next week. He said, hey, will you come play this show in New York and do all these TV dates with us? And I said, well, heck yeah. Like, who wouldn't want to do that? Mm-hmm. And then that turned into to playing his tours. He would go out and play with Loving Mary, and I would make whatever shows I can. And you know, I told Steven, I said, man, if you don't want me playing fiddle on everything, he's like, no. He's like, just play. Like, he totally trusted my musicianship, and I definitely didn't want to freak out his hardcore fans. Like, what is a fiddle doing up there? But there was a banjo on stage and mandolin, but people loved it. Like, it was so fun. And the band was rocking. Sarah Tomac on drums is a badass, a bad mamma jamma. and she, it was just really fun. So if you have a chance to go, we're actually in a documentary they did called Out on a Limb, and we did a show at the Ryman, and it was so fun. Like, and I'll still get calls from him every once in a while, just to do a date here and there. Yeah, that's always a call I love to get.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, I mean, this is the range here from Steven Tyler to Del McCurry in your sort of resume is just stunning, and must be very satisfying to an all-around musician, because that's what it looks like, is a musician's resume. And of course, the CMA Musician of the Year, or is it musician or instrumentalist?
It's called Musician of the Year now. Yeah, it used to be called instrumentalist.
Yeah, no, this recently happened. Congratulations.
Oh my goodness, thank you.
How do you sort of analyze, from knowing the business side of this town and the way the CMA works, what do you feel like was between you and that prize in terms of the talent level, the institutional forces, you being a woman? There's a whole list of things that could have stood between you and that prize, but you got it. And how do you process that?
I don't know. Like, it was such a dream of mine, but I don't even know if I even believed that I could get it. Like, it was one of those things, like, these are my heroes that won that award. Like, you know, I grew up watching Mark O'Connor win it, and I'm sure Brent Mason won it, and Paul Franklin, and gosh, Mac McAnally had won it for 8 or 9 years in a row. I mean, these are my heroes, and it's still kind of like, I'm like, did this really happen? It's still a bit of a dream for me, but I've worked my butt off, I will say that. And I've had this dream for a long, long time, and it probably, just the fact I even got on the ballot, it came maybe sooner than I thought in my career. Like, I don't know, but I feel like people are ready to hear fiddle again as well.
Great. That's nice to hear. Good.
Makes me really excited. And I don't think a fiddle player had been nominated for, oh my gosh, a long time. Someone the other day said 10, 20 years, but I can't remember the date, but I was just like, what in the world? and there was a time that award, there was 2 and 3 fiddle players in there. I don't know if I even answered your question, but it's still such an honor and a dream. And I hope it inspires, you know, these girls out there that are wanting this. It's never anything I was like, being a woman, that I thought it would hold me back. I never felt that at all. And it's unfortunate there's not more women doing session work. And I'm not sure why that is. But I certainly hope it broke some glass ceilings as far as that's concerned.
Superb. You sound like somebody that really has respect for this industry, that if you were to tell some folks back home, you know, aunts or folks at church, you know, like, well, what is it like really? You'd have good things to say about the way that this business in Nashville operates.
Yeah. Like all these guys are my friends, my dear friends, like, and even stuck in this quarantine, like I messaged, Derek Wells, who was, you know, he was in the CMA Musician of the Year category. Oh my gosh, one of the most incredible guitar players. But we, you know, I was leaning on him. Like, he made a beautiful post about this quarantine, and he was reaching out to people, and he's like, if you need any help, please reach out to me. And I reached out to him. I was like, hey, let me know if anybody reached out to you, because I want to help too, you know, in any way I can. Like, you know, there's these young musicians that have just moved to town, and now we're all, you know, we're struggling. I'm very fortunate that I'm still getting some work from home, but I know, you know, there's these people playing on Broadway and they've lost all their income. Yeah. But we're all in this together. Yeah.
Well, to start to wrap up here, definitely want to ask you about what your goals are as a singer-songwriter here and an artist now that you've put two singles out, and where's this heading in your mind?
Well, you know, I hope to put out some more music. I put out a record when I was with Martina McBride, probably, 8 years ago or so. And okay. I love songwriting as well. And I love singing, and I hope, you know, I can do some shows here and there. I was going to do a show at CMA Fest. We were working on figuring out which stage, but I just, you know, I heard CMA Fest was canceled, but, I've been doing some Instagram Live and Facebook Live shows, just because that's all we have right now. So maybe I can put together a little tour. I have goals of getting more of my songs cut, and I need to kick my own butt for that but like I said, like I stay so busy playing on other people's records and that sometimes I'm like, oh yeah, I have all these songs that I need to be pitching as well. So it's sometimes hard to juggle everything, but.
So there's not necessarily an album on the way, but you're open to.
Well, I think
cutting tracks, or do you think there is?
You know, there's so many people like just putting out singles. So I kind of had an idea for my next single after this. That's kind of the route I'm taking right now. And plus, you can't book a session right now with a bunch of people in the room, but you can always do it from home. So I'm just kind of figuring that part out. We were on Blake's tour, you know, and so I thought I was going to be busy doing that right now, but I might be focusing on putting out some more of my music. I should be, at least.